from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Generally speaking, in the West, if you go woke, you won't go broke. Whereas if you go anti-woke, you'll get broken. The lefties will put you out of business because they mobilize as consumers.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. David Azarad, our first guest on today's program. David is assistant professor and research fellow at Hillsdale College's Van Andel Graduate School of Government in Washington, D.C. We talked at length about his recent piece at Real Clear Public Affairs titled On the Peculiar Character of American Racism. Dr. Azarad, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be back, Scott.
You begin by saying that America is a racist country is the great self-evident truth of the left and of the ruling class whose moral opinions are shaped by it. What are the accusations here against America?
Well, the first thing that's, I think, important to realize is that the accusations are secondary and change over time. This is a creedal, confessional, dogmatic statement. It's an axiom. It's an irrefutable, unfalsifiable proposition for them. It begins to be developed at a time when America is indeed racist. I mean, I don't think anyone denies that in the 50s with Jim Crow and then the general prejudices that existed throughout the population, even in the North, America was to varying degrees in different parts of the country a racist country. But what's interesting to notice is as the country has grown less and less racist in the traditional sense of the term, as the laws have been changed, as the opinion of the public has been changed, as more and more measures have been put in place to benefit and help blacks primarily, but also other non-white groups, the accusations of racism have not subsided. If anything, they've grown louder. And the left has grown more and more hysterical. So I'm happy to discuss the particulars, but I think the first thing we need to understand is that this is a dogmatic assertion, and then the evidence comes afterwards and is always adaptable to the circumstances. Now, to answer your question, I mean, they've basically been defining racism down because the old forms of racism that anyone could recognize, you know, laws that took into account race,
mm-hmm.
and prevented the races from mixing, from marrying, that there was unequal application of the law, and then the fact that there were widespread prejudices. You know, one of the most interesting ones is interracial marriage. I mean, Gallup has been looking at this for many decades. You know, I don't remember if it was in the 50s or 60s, it was something like 87% of Americans disapproved of interracial marriage. Today, I think it's less than 10%. Gallup calls it one of the largest shifts in polling that it has ever witnessed. So all of these things have disappeared. And so what evidence do they have that America is racist? Well, they point to unequal group outcomes, the fact that blacks represent 13% of the population, but they're not 13% of CEOs, astronauts, scientists, Nobel laureates, senators. So that's a big one, as if the only explanation for unequal group outcomes were racism.
So what is the benefit? Why are there organizations, sectors, individuals who wish to keep America, again, quote unquote, racist in perpetuity?
Oh, I mean, the benefits are enormous. I mean, this is the other thing is, you know, to put it in crass Machiavellian terms, the left would have to be crazy to give up on that claim because it's its greatest source of power, because it occupies the moral high ground in America, because it has made racism the one unforgivable sin that trumps all others and effaces all good deeds and erases all good deeds. So the central piety of America in the 21st century is that racism directed against non-whites, because racism directed against whites happens all the time, and we forget that. No one seems to particularly care about it. You don't get canceled for that. Is the greatest piety of the regime. You know, one way to see it is, you can swear as much as you want and mock Christian icons, but when it comes to the N-word, you don't even pronounce it. You know, it's like the Jews who do not say the name of God, because it's the central piety. So this is the great piety, and they use the unfounded accusations of racism to silence critics and keep the right and everyone who disagrees with them in check, because the left may be corrupt, it may support policies that have done terrible damage to the black family, to black communities. It may have, you know, more flaws than we can count, but at least it claims by definition not to be racist. I mean, how could it be? It exists to eliminate racism. And so it is, you know, in any political conflict, I mean, of course you want money and you want power and you want institutions, but you want to occupy the moral high ground.
David Azred with us, talking about his Real Clear public affairs piece on the peculiar character of American racism. You write something interesting. Corporate America is afraid of socialism, not of Black Lives Matter. I think people might look at some of the actions by corporations and think it perhaps is the opposite. Why do you think that corporate America really is afraid of socialism and not of Black Lives Matter in that movement?
So Black Lives Matter to me is a stand-in for social justice or, you know, wokeness, the avant-garde obsession with race, sex, sexual orientation, and now gender identity, as opposed to class. And the reason that is that it turns out that for the time being, at least, BLM, the social justice warriors, the wokies, can readily be bought off with performative wokeness, i.e. fly the gay flag, put up the BLM sign, hire a couple of diversities and park them in the C-suite, donate a bit of money to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and they leave you alone. It allows the corporations, and I should add, the billionaires, the oligarchs, the most powerful people in America, to morally launder their corporate nature, their wealth, and their privilege through a very cheap signaling mechanism that really costs them very little. Whereas the demands of, say, Occupy Wall Street at the time could not be met with such simple, you know, performative socialism.
Mm-hmm.
They had a much deeper principled hostility to wealth, power, and big business. Whereas the wokies are agnostic on wealth. What they hate is racism. Now, at the end of the day, if you go to the BLM, you know, you read the BLM manifesto, they are anti-capitalist. They want expropriation in order to redistribute wealth, to equalize wealth between the races. So in the long term, there is a fundamental contradiction between the imperatives of capitalism and corporate America, namely profits, growth, and efficiency,
mm-hmm.
and the demands of social justice wokeism, which is, you know, ensuring that their groups get a slice of the pie, and to hell with efficiency, competency, and merit. It doesn't matter if the person doing the job is good at it. All that matters is their sex, sexual orientation, or skin color. And then furthermore, the more radical elements are also openly hostile to capitalism. It just turns out that for the time being, they're all pretty readily bought off with this fake signaling that you really care about these issues that cost very little and allow you to go on with your core activity of making a lot of money.
We'll pause there, talking with Dr. David Azred about his recent essay at Real Clear Public Affairs on the peculiar character of American racism. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We continue with Dr. David Azarad, Assistant Professor and Research Fellow at Hillsdale College's Van Andel Graduate School of Government in Washington, D.C. His recent essay for Real Clear Public Affairs is titled On the Peculiar Character of American Racism. I want to ask then about what recently happened in the NBA, perhaps the most woke of these sports leagues, and always discussing social justice, and yet you have an NBA owner in Mark Cuban of the Dallas Mavericks who announces, we are going to stop playing the national anthem before games. And I think there was an expectation that the NBA and the commissioner would say, all right, you've done it, Mark Cuban, great job, you do what you believe is right. And instead, the NBA comes back and says, no, you're going to play the national anthem. We are all playing the national anthem before games. What is that line, then, that they won't cross?
Well, they're still concerned with, you know, making money. So this is the great lie of woke capitalism, is that it claims to be about wokeness when what it really is about, ultimately, is capitalism. And generally speaking, in the West, if you go woke, you won't go broke. Whereas if you go anti-woke, you'll get broken. The lefties will put you out of business because they mobilize as consumers. The people who get offended by wokeness and social justice, conservatives, libertarians, just generally patriotic Americans, mobilize as voters, as donors, as citizens. They tend not to mobilize as consumers. They tend not to boycott. On the whole, if you're a big business, it's a safe bet to completely ignore your conservative or right-of-center base and only cater to the left side of your consumer base because you're afraid of them. Now, there's obviously some limits, and I'm not privy to what goes on within the senior management of the NBA, but I would think that they're thinking this would be crossing a line. You know, the other place where you really see the hypocrisy is on China, where all of these businesses, and the NBA in particular, are so eager to do business with the regime that is, you know, harvesting the organs of political prisoners, rounding up Uyghurs and putting them in re-education camps. You know, it's an authoritarian one-party state, and no one cares.
David Azarad with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I wanted to ask about this word we are now hearing so much of in the past 4 to 5 weeks or so specifically, and that is equity. We of course, talk a lot about equality when we talk about the Constitution and our government here in the United States, but now all of a sudden we are hearing equity. How does this word equity perhaps play into what you wrote about here?
It's the same thing with, you know, what's wrong with justice? The West has, you know, going back to Plato's Republic, centuries, thousands of years of deep reasoning about the nature of justice, and now it turns out that justice isn't enough. We need social justice. Look, it's the same thing with the shift from equality to equity, is that I don't want to call them traditional, I want to call them fair, honest, just conceptions of equality, justice, the rule of law, rights, are not capable of delivering what they want, which is more power, wealth, and honor for the good groups, i.e. the groups that are supposedly oppressed, and then punishing and humiliating the bad groups, whites, Christians, men, straight people, conservatives, Republicans, you name it. You can't justify that under a just framework of rights. You can't justify that according to the conception of justice, I think, that the majority of Americans, regardless of their skin color or sex, hold on to. And so they redefine these terms. They tweak them. And this allows them to push their agenda. They're, in effect, saying, you know, equality is not enough. Equality is not good. Now, you may say, well, there's only one alternative to equality, and that's inequality. But that would be a bad, from a PR point of view, that's not a good position for them to defend.
Mm-hmm.
So what do they say instead? Is they say, no, we're for equity. But look, if you reject equality, you're embracing inequality, which is exactly exactly what they're doing. Namely, the good groups, the recognized oppressed identity groups, they get the spoils, and then the bad groups get punished and humiliated. That's the guiding principle of identity politics, of critical race theory, of social justice, of equity thinking, of the woke left.
Speaking of words, the phrase institutional racism, the phrase systemic racism, seem to imply that there are institutions or systems here in this country that are devoted to racism, or at least are racist. Where would we possibly see that here in the U.S.?
I'm sorry that I'm laughing, Scott, but just to pose the question shows you what an utterly ridiculous question that is. I mean, there is not a single institution of any significant size in America, I mean, aside from the most marginal, maligned, insignificant, you know, internet groups that is openly anti-black.
Mm-hmm.
Quite the contrary. I challenge you to find a major institution in America, whether it be in the government, at any level of government, in the private sector, in the nonprofits, in the religious sectors, that is not openly, actively trying to curry favor with blacks in particular and other minorities to a lesser extent. That is not going out of its way to try to recruit them, hire them, promote them, celebrate their accomplishments, be solicitous towards them. And yet, we're supposed to swallow this ridiculous lie that the major, I mean, the place you most see it is the universities. I mean, mm-hmm. No institutions are more woke than America's elite universities. Let me put it to you this way. No institutions in the history of mankind have been more actively devoted to eradicating white racism than the universities. And yet the people who live there, the students and the faculty, think that they're borderline within inches of the Fourth Reich or the Ku Klux Klan taking power, and that these institutions are infected with racism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I laugh because the alternative is to cry. I mean, it's complete folly. And yet it gets repeated at the highest levels, you know, from the president on down. So if it were, I think we need to laugh about it. I mean, I think these claims are, they need to be refuted. They need to be argued against. They also need to be mocked. And this is one thing that fanatics of all stripes can never handle, is mockery.
David Azarad, assistant professor and research fellow at Hillsdale College's Van Andel Graduate School of Government in Washington, D.C. You can also read this piece that we've been discussing at realclearpublicaffairs.com on the peculiar character of American racism, part of Real Clear Public Affairs' 1776 series of essays. David, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott. Always a pleasure.
Up next, Ian Rowe from the American Enterprise Institute will join us to talk about an essay on lowered expectations in education. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Did you know that the City of Reading has started licensing commercial cannabis activities within the city limits? Synergy is the first of the city's approved retailers to obtain licensure, bringing to the Reading area the most experienced retailer in the North State. They will ensure that your visit is both professional and comfortable. Access is simple and discreet. Synergy has a private 25-space parking lot at the back of the building. Synergy is located at 345 Hempstead Drive, Reading.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Hi, I'm Sue Blake with Powerhouse Solar. Solar energy not only makes financial sense, but right now you can go solar for zero money down. And you may qualify to get the 26% federal tax credit. At Powerhouse Solar, we are an elite dealer for SunPower, and we install the most cost-effective and highest efficiency panels. A lot of people don't realize they have options now. You can get the SunPower SunVault battery and solar with financing. So keeping the lights on when the grid goes down is easier than ever. And the entire system is backed by their 25-year warranty. Powerhouse Solar can design a system for your specific needs. Call Powerhouse Solar today at 275-5600 or visit us on the web at powerhousesolar.com. Again, call Powerhouse Solar at 275-5600 or visit us online at powerhousesolar.com.
I expected it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of this show. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu, radiohour.hillsdale.edu, and enter your address. We're joined by Ian Rowe, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a senior visiting fellow at the Woodson Center, and also in the process of founding a new network of high schools called the Vertex Partnership Academies in New York City. You can also find him on Twitter at Ian V. Rowe. Ian, thanks so much for joining us.
Scott, thank you very much for having me on.
We talk on the subject of education and a piece that you wrote that appeared recently in the USA Today, Lowering Expectations in Education is Just a Form of Soft Bigotry, is the headline on it. People can find that at usatoday.com. You begin with an anecdote about what's happening in San Diego, and judging by things I've read elsewhere, it sounds like it's a familiar story for districts across the country. But what is happening out in San Diego?
Well, thank you for asking me, Scott. Throughout America, as you know, there's a national reckoning on race. And certainly within the education community, there's an effort to try and understand how to close achievement gaps between kids of different races, how to improve outcomes. And that has led to what I call this sort of anti-racist movement, which on its surface sounds great. Of course, who wants to be considered racist? But a number of these anti-racist initiatives actually seem to be racist in their execution. And what occurred in San Diego is that during the 2019-20 school year, in the first semester, the leadership looked at the outcomes for different kids, and they found that 80% of black students received a passing grade or passing in all their classes. And they discovered that 93% of white students were receiving passing grades. And they wanted to say, okay, how could we improve those outcomes? And rather than ask, well, what is it that these 80 80% of Black students are doing? Is it that they're studying more hours at night? Are they taking advantage of teacher tutor hours? What is it? What are the ingredients of success? Instead, the district said, no, we're going to look at the failure rate. And they saw that 20% of Black students were receiving either a D or an F grade, and 7% of white students were receiving a D or an F. And they determined that that 13 percentage point differential between the Black and white students' failure rate must be due to systemic racism. And then as a result, the entire district was going to become an anti-racist school district. And so they said, well, you know, for somehow on the racist assumption that predominantly Black students can't get their homework in on time, let's remove that restriction for all 106,000 students in San Diego school system no longer need to hand their homework in on time. It's such a terrible example of how this anti-racist action actually is resulting in lower standards for all students. And rather than focus on the ingredients of success, there's a desire to achieve equity of failure.
You write in the piece that if you read the mission statement of any educational organization, you could find language similar to seeking to attain equity by closing the racial achievement gap. Is that, in so many words, the wrong goal to have?
It's absolutely the wrong goal. We should be focused on excellence for all kids. You know, in the United States, there's something called the Nation's Report Card, where every couple of years, particularly in reading and math, we assess how all kids are doing in the country. And unfortunately, we as a country have a long way to go. It's still the case that only about one-third of all eighth-grade students across race are achieving proficiency in reading at the eighth-grade level. And so when you're talking about racial achievement gaps, it's never been the case that even 50% of white students are reading at proficiency level in the entire history of that test being administered since 1992. So even if you were to close the racial achievement gap between Black and white students, all you'd be doing is moving Black students from sub-mediocrity to full mediocrity, which is absolutely crazy. We need to be focused on excellence for all kids, regardless of race.
You mentioned earlier, Ian, that in districts in which there is some racial disparity, that there's a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to blame systemic racism. What would be or what could be other common reasons or causes for the results that we see in some of the districts?
Yeah, well, there's an unfortunate, most of this anti-racist doctrine, even if it's never named, is all founded on critical race theory. And critical race theory holds that any racial disparity, of course, any racial disparity that's negative, must be due to structural racism. So if you have different outcomes in reading based on race, then there must be some implicit or explicit bias on the part of teachers. And obviously that can't be true if it's never been the case that not even 50% of white students in the country are reading at proficiency, then it's not structural racism that is holding white students back, right? So there must be other factors. And once we actually start to reject this idea of what I call mono causality, meaning there's only one reason, it must be structural racism, then you actually start to entertain all the other factors that drive student success. Some of it has to do with individual behaviors. How many hours spent per night are kids reading? How many books do they have access to? And then there's structural factors, like are teachers trained in the most effective ways to teach? And then there are very important non-school factors. And something I often write about is the stability and structure of the families in which our kids are raised. And, you know, rarely do we talk about the explosion in non-marital birth rates, particularly the young women 24 and under. and the environments that are then likely to be created for children who are learning.
Talking with Ian Rowe about his piece at the USA Today, usatoday.com, Lowering Expectations in Education is Just a Soft Form of Soft Bigotry. You write, toward the end, the American dream is premised on the idea that a young person can become an agent of her or his own destiny. How do we make that belief a reality?
Well, first of all, we don't tell kids that they live in a country that's hostile to their dreams. I mean, imagine if you are a black child growing up in America right now and you're listening to the dominant narrative. You know, you hear that the country's founding ideals were false when they were written, that America has anti-black racism built into its DNA. If you hear that enough, you start to believe, why even bother? Because the system is so rigged against me, it's not worth me even trying. And that's why discredited projects like the New York Times 1619 Project, which, you know, really tell a false history, cherry-picked history that paint the country as irredeemably racist, are so dangerous. And so instead, we need to, for all kids, teach the embrace of the founding principles of family, faith, hard work, entrepreneurship. Those have been the behaviors that have been embraced by millions and millions of people to move from persecution to prosperity and to achieve the American dream.
Ian Rowe, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org, senior visiting fellow at the Woodson Center, and also founding a new network of high schools in the New York City area, the Vertex Partnership Academies. You can also read this piece at usatoday.com. Ian, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Up next, Ken Calvert from Hillsdale's History Department will join us to talk about Alexander the Great. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Premier, your friendly oil change.
The seasons are changing. Keeping your family healthy is important. So is the health of your car. The longevity of your vehicle depends on you to make sure your oil, radiator, coolant, windshield wipers, and other vital systems have all been taken care of so your car can bring your healthy family through the seasons. Drive into Premier Oil Change today and experience the friendly oil change. Premier doesn't require an appointment, and you don't drop your car off or wait. Premier changes your fluids while you stay in the comfort and safety of your own car. Enjoy a free beverage and free Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point certified service. Earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palo Cedro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park, or in Anderson across from Round Table Pizza. All locations, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Home of the friendly oil change.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6:05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6:05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. This month's review is Kintsugi by Alec and Bradley. Kintsugi is a pleasurable, medium-bodied experience. Notes of cinnamon, earth, and wood are prominent throughout, with very subtle hints of amaretto and almonds. Come down to the shop for your Kintsugi today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, or visit us on Instagram at Tobacco and Brew.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We say hello and thank you to our listeners on WHAK 960 AM in Rogers City, Michigan. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Dr. Ken Calvert, professor of ancient history at Hillsdale College. Dr. Calvert, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Scott.
Talking about Alexander the Great. So great, we're going to do it in two parts. Oh, at least. Maybe we'll do more
right.
later.
Yeah,
but the first part, of course, really kind of before Alexander and then very early in his reign. Before we talk Alexander, let's talk about Alexander's father, Philip II, first. What was Macedonia's status under him? What's happening around him?
Right. Philip II, 4th century guy, began to... 382 to 336, right around there. Philip inherited a region, a kingdom that was fairly disunified. And he had a vision. He had an idea that he was going to create Macedonia into, bring the Macedonians into a unified territory, bring them all together, and create a genuinely Greek society there. They were kind of off to the side. They were kind of viewed as the Hicks, of Greece. All the action was down at Athens, Corinth, Sparta, you know, that territory to the south.
Mm-hmm.
Philip wanted to do something bigger and better, and really an interesting man. Unified the Greek aristocrats, the nobility, even those who didn't want to, either were going to unify or not survive, you know, marched and took over different territories, added them to the Macedonian, small Macedonian empire there, and ultimately defeated the Greek city-states to the south. But really what Philip did was march into a vacuum, a political and military vacuum, and make the Greeks, you know, obey him, mm-hmm. you know, come under his rule. And he did that through a couple of battles and some very, very good politics.
So what was his plan? What was his end game? What was he going to do once he consolidated this power?
Really, his idea was not to destroy classical Greece and not to suppress classical Greece. And Athens actually being his vision for the future, he wanted to take the best of what had been created and bring it back to life, enhance it. He created a league, the League of Corinth, which was supposed to be somewhat independent and, you know, everyone able to work through and argue through and create legislation, and he allowed some of that. But for all intents and purposes, he was a monarch, you know, over the League of Corinth and mm-hmm. over these other Greek city-states. And though, you know, you have people like Demosthenes and others who complained about Philip, what's important to understand is that he actually did recover much of that great Greek past, mm-hmm. especially the cultural past. He allowed Athens to continue to be a democracy. He allowed Athens to continue to complain about him as a monarch, you know. And it's very, very interesting that he had this kind of patient attitude towards these other Greek city-states and allowed them to be, for all intents and purposes, who they were, as long as they didn't rebel against him, mm-hmm. right? So he's creating a new unified Greek world. His physician, the palace physician in Pella, his son is Aristotle.
Mm.
Okay, so Aristotle's Macedonian, and so we have to make that connection between Aristotle, his Macedonian roots, and Athens as well. And that's going to, of course, come along you know, with Alexander,
right?
Because Alexander, the son and heir of Philip II, Philip's going to want this boy to be well educated and well trained.
Let's talk about a few of those things more specifically. So Alexander, Philip's son, was educated by Aristotle.
That's correct.
What kind of an influence did that have on him?
Well, that is something that all historians kind of scratch their heads over. Okay, so our sources for Alexander the Great are Romans, Plutarch and Arrian, both writing in the first century into the second century A.D.,
mm-hmm.
about 400 to 500 years later, right? So, but what are their sources? Their sources seem to be the library at Alexandria. And we have some evidence that letters and records and all of this kind of material was kept at Alexandria from this invasion, and records of Alexander's life. So what we have in terms of his education and what we know of his interaction with Aristotle is that he probably had about 2 years with this great philosopher, that this philosopher was called home, and Philip paid for him in a special, you know, school location to have his son Alexander and another group of Alexander's peers,
mm-hmm.
To be educated by Aristotle. What did Alexander learn from him? Well, there is some good evidence that Aristotle poured into him, you know, his understanding of politics, his study of politics, his study of metaphysics. At one point in Plutarch's description, Alexander writes a letter back to Aristotle. And Alexander's complaining to Aristotle, why are you publishing your stuff? This should only be for, you know, this higher level thinking, you know, metaphysical, philosophical thinking should only be set aside for the highest level students.
Mm.
You know, why are you publishing this? And so, you know, it's a very, we don't have the answer as to why, you know, but Aristotle's probably trying to earn some bucks.
Yeah,
you know, some
money
off. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If only he knew what we were selling today. You know, but you know, the thing is that it's very clear that Alexander, or at least we suspect, that Alexander was receiving from Aristotle some of Aristotle's most profound thinking.
Hmm.
All right. So, you know, probably the greatest question that philosophers and historians want to get at is, does Alexander meet the definition of Aristotle's magnanimous man?
Does Alexander begin to change in ways once he finds success in the world and wins on the battlefield?
As he is more and more successful, he begins to lose touch with that.
Hmm.
And he begins to lose touch with his Greekness, and he becomes more and more of a Persian emperor. And so, you know, there is a question at the end of his life as to whether or not Aristotle actually took part in an assassination,
mm-hmm.
of Alexander. And I think is not true. And of course, you know, all those who love Aristotle are going to pull their hair out and say, no, of course he wouldn't, you know, be involved in that. But the fact that Alexander did not really live up to that ideal of the magnanimous man, and as a young man who learned from a number of teachers, he applied many of those Aristotelian and Greek ideals. But the further east he went,
mm-hmm.
The less connected he was with those foundations.
Yeah. But let's fill in a little bit more before we end this particular segment. If he's educated by Aristotle, he's also trained and taught by his father,
right,
on the battlefield to be
exactly
a warrior. Where do we see him excel on the battlefield?
Well, at the Battle of Chaeronea, in particular, his father is fighting against an allied force of Athens and Corinth and other Greek city-states. And what you see with Alexander really rushes forward with his cavalry and is able to turn the tide in favor of the Macedonians. He's audacious. He's brave, almost to the point of being, a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
but he is able to do this. In fact, he grows up with the idea that he is the son of Zeus, that he is a god. He is like Hercules In fact, all of his imagery is Herculean imagery on the coins and everything else with our man Alexander. But you have definitely this audacious attitude on the field of battle, and that's going to follow him through all of his military activity.
Yeah. Dr. Ken Calvert, Professor of Ancient History at Hillsdale College. Thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to David Azarad from Hillsdale in D.C., talking about his latest essay on the peculiar character of American racism. Ian Rowe from the American Enterprise Institute on lowered expectations in schools. And Ken Calvert from Hillsdale's History Department, the first part of our conversation on Alexander the Great. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hey guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441. This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Some things in life you can just rely on. Like the comfy fit of a favorite pair of jeans and the tried and true performance of a new home comfort system from Rood. So here's to reliability built into everything we do. Rely on Rood.
Get reliable comfort when the weather turns cold with a new heating system installed by the local pros at Alliance Heating and Air. Call Alliance Heating and Air today at 530-221-2642.
Readers tend to like a character who is at least superficially like themselves, but they quickly lose interest unless this particular character is somehow out of the ordinary. Orson Scott Card.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Holt.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Happy December.
Yay.
We hope you had a good Thanksgiving and are looking forward to all of the festive holidays that are happening this month. As we do in December, we are doing a Frequently Asked Questions series. So we've taken your questions that you've submitted. We've taken questions that we see commonly when we are in writing forums and other places, questions that we get asked a lot, and trying to answer them here quickly and succinctly so that you know where to go, where to move forward. So what is today's question?
How descriptive are you with characters and landscape appearances? When do you describe them? And what about the sequel? Do you describe them then also?
So let's take this from the beginning. How descriptive do you get with character and landscape appearances?
My answer, as little as possible.
There are different approaches to the idea of describing characters, and it is somewhat genre-specific, but most experienced authors will agree on a couple of things. And one of those is you do not ever give a head-to-toe description just because.
Yeah, it's not often your character is going to stand in front of a mirror and notice the color of their own eyes.
No.
If anything, people tend to be self-critical. They're going to dislike something about themselves unless they're an incredibly vain character.
So it does depend on the character. That's the other thing experienced authors can agree on. It depends on the character, what they notice, and what they would describe. So, when do you describe characters? And this will go into how descriptive you get.
When I am describing any character, it's almost never from that character's point of view. He is noticing her across the room. She is checking somebody out.
It depends on the point of view. But you need to have a specific reason for describing the character in that moment. Think about the last time you met someone. How much about them did you notice? Did you really go full creeper and do a full body scan, taking note of every aspect of their body?
I really hope if you do this, there's some sort of comedic twist at the end. You're looking at her from the back and across the bar. And you see the fantastic stiletto heels that perfectly match the short skirt and the long legs in between, the slender waist to get up to the front. The character turns around and full beard or something just completely off the wall. We're like, oh, okay, we're going on a different path here.
Again, that's a specific plot device to use there. Number one, your readers don't want to be overwhelmed with description. It gets boring. And number two, the more vague you are, especially with your main character, the more connected your reader can feel to them.
I would say most of the time, if I'm describing a character, that character is probably going to die in the length of the scene. This is mostly because I don't want to name guard one and guard two, so I'm going to say the fat one and the one with the stupid hair. They aren't going to last long. Not long enough for me to name them, but if they have two different bits of choreography, they need to be differentiated, therefore physical attributes are an easy way to do that.
So another time to describe that goes along with there's a specific reason is if there's something atypical about that character's body. Maybe they're missing an eye. Maybe they have severe scars on their face or some kind of disfigurement that stands out that will catch your main character's eye first.
Again, when your character is noticing something about themselves, it's rarely going to be a positive note, because that's how a lot of people are, especially if your main character at the beginning of your story is going to believe a lie about themselves. I just had a scene where my character caught a glimpse of herself in a mirror, and she immediately turned away, because she doesn't like what she sees.
when it comes to your main character's hair color, that kind of stuff, there needs to be a reason for it. So for my main character in my last book, because she likes to dye her hair, she has black hair with emerald.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.